Hey, it's Staff Sergeant Hearn.
And I'm Sergeant Megan Terry.
And welcome back to another episode of AGR, Alabama Guard Radio. Recruiting is down nationwide. If you read the headlines, it's becoming more and more of a struggle to get young people to join the military. And we could kind of go back and forth all day on why that may be. But the interesting thing is, in Alabama, that's not the case. In fact, we're killing it. Our numbers are up, and we're having one of the best recruiting years ever in what is a nationwide drought. So we decided to talk to some recruiters, find out what we're doing different than everybody else. But a term came up they kept saying, which was unicorns. Megan, you used to be a recruiter. Can you tell me what that is?
I was a recruiter, and I wished that I was a recruiter in Alabama because they're doing so good. But a unicorn is basically an applicant who comes into your office. They want to join. They're ready to join. They have everything taken care of that they need to have taken care of, and they don't have any disqualifying factors. So, for example, if you walked into a recruiting office, you had no medical issues, you had all your education squared away, and you didn't have any reservations or doubts, and everything was cool, and you could enlist as soon as possible, you're a unicorn.
So basically, they don't exist.
Not anymore, they don't. Well, they're changing some things, though, because now you can join with ADHD and other things. They're expanding, but yeah, pretty much in today's day and age, post-COVID, they don't exist.
Well, I was really interested in the term. So today, me and Megan decided to go hunt down our own unicorn, and we came across retired First Sergeant Sandra Lucas. She was prior Navy. She joined the Alabama National Guard at 41 years old at a time where the military wasn't really kind to women. She also had a very successful civilian career going on, and she'd already done her time, but we kind of wanted to know what made her make this life decision.
Hi, I'm Sandra Lucas, retired First Sergeant, Army National Guard, and started off in the Navy back in the late 70s. Joined the Navy, I guess, to see the world. I was hoping to go to the West Coast. I had a boyfriend out there. But things turned out that I ended up on the East Coast in working at headquarters. I was a young kid, didn't know much. Really kind of a fun time. People were coming back from Vietnam. We were in a peace state, if you will. We had the Cold War going on. But as young as I was and given where my head was at, I really didn't, I didn't put all that together again until later in life, what that all meant. But we were still having some protests around then. People would spit on you if you had your uniform on and you were out in public. So we wore our uniforms once a week during that time period, and you went to work and straight home. You didn't stop for groceries or gas or any of that because it just was too dangerous. It was a very different time when I first started out. I spent 4 years in the Navy, grew up there, really learned a lot of discipline from some really great people. But we didn't have the value system that we eventually would grow to have in the military. I think people before us had a really great value system. They were very honorable. You look back to the Korean War and World War II, and Vietnam started to change things in post-Vietnam. You know, things were really getting kind of weird in the military. While I was in, one of the big fiascos that took place was something called Tailhook. When we began, that really does mark the day we began to look at sexual harassment and the role of a woman in uniform and how she gets treated. Although a lot of women had broke through that glass ceiling and were doing great things in the military, it was still a difficult time for women. They were harassed, touched, threatened, and there was just no place to report it because the mentality was, if you joined, because it was all volunteer, then you were asking for it, and it just wasn't always a good place to be. I was pre-Women at Sea. While I was there, one of the programs that Congress eventually would vote and give to us was permission for women to go to sea. And just toward the end of my enlistment, I was asked, or actually I was given my next set of orders, which would have been my first set of orders after being in the MECPON's office and the Chief of Naval Personnel's office. And I was going to the USS Lexington, which is now something everybody's using to shave with because she's all scrap. But she was a down in Pensacola, and the pilots would use her to do touch and goes. She was an old aircraft carrier. I drove down to Pensacola and took a look at it. It was a rust bucket. I was going to be the first and probably the only female for a little while to go on the ship. And something in me just said, no, this just is not the right thing for me to do. I had read many cases that we processed about women at sea and what was happening, and it was a tough transition. It was hard. Today it's much better, and we have things in place now for women to be able to go to and talk to others to prevent that from happening. We train. We have open discussions. That old mindset is simply not acceptable. And if anybody is out dealing with it, then by all means, say something, because that's just not today. Too many women fought hard to get that changed, and I'd hate to see that anyone was suffering with that today.
So Sandra's now out of the Navy, and she decides to start working with this amazing new technology, which at the time, it was computers. And like Sandra says...
That's a long time ago. But
she really had a knack for it, though, and she started training office workers in how to use word processors and even spreadsheets.
It was a wonderful time to train people to kind of bring about this new change and to find efficiencies. And that's really where I think I found my niche was, one, working with people to make them better and to make them comfortable with the stress that the job was bringing with the change. But two, just the ability to create efficiencies and make something better just really excited me. That took me to one job. You don't really plan a career like the one I've had.
She goes from teaching computers to working Navy finance, buying engines for ships, and she ends up working her way up into Navy command at the Pentagon, working with them to determine how they're going to shape and pay for the future of the Navy.
But anyway, so I made friends in the Pentagon, a lot of friends, young people my age, starting life, people who had, you know, real young families just starting, that kind of thing.
She stayed at the Pentagon, learning, meeting people, and making connections, but never settling into her career.
Yeah, and eventually, she caught the eyes of some congressmen on Capitol Hill, and she started getting involved in politics, working their campaigns and helping behind the scenes. And around this point, she met her husband, who worked for the Air Force, and eventually, they relocated to Alabama.
In Alabama, while she lived in Montgomery, she got involved in state politics, even working with Senate campaigns and the governor's office and officials in the Alabama National Guard. All the while, she starts getting this itch that she can do more, and that she's not quite finished with the military. But at her age, I mean, that really wasn't an option for her. But then something nobody expected to happen happened, and that was ultimately her ticket back into the military.
My friends had, we had moved to Alabama by that time, and my friends had said, you know, you just need to calm down, stop watching the news so much, because, you know, getting national news all the time wasn't really happening. You know, you get your pieces of it, and I'm a news junkie. Public affairs, news, all that. So I decided to listen to some friends I'd made, my new friends in Alabama, and didn't turn it on. So I called my friend, Tracy, and said, hey, you'd be so proud of me. It's noon, and I haven't turned on the TV yet. And Tracy said, turn on the TV, and hung up. That was 9/11. I did call after the shock of it all, after, you know, you start to think, okay, what am I going to do? My husband was in lockdown over at Gunner. And I had, you know, it's like you got to do something. So I called the congressman's office. And they were shocked. They didn't, how did you get through? Because they couldn't get out. The lines going out were all blocked. And I sat there for about half an hour or so with a cell phone and a and a landline connecting them so they could talk to each other, putting the phones together, and then, you know, somebody else would get on the line and then I'd dial their home, and that way their loved ones would know that they were okay, because it was a concern that it was going to go to Capitol Hill and might have had things not happened. And 9/11, when the plane crashed into the Pentagon, it took five of my friends out. And I couldn't, I could volunteer, I could give blood, I could donate, I could do lots of stuff, but I just couldn't get whatever that thing is deep down inside. I couldn't get that. I just couldn't get it to go away. So we're sitting there with the adjutant general of the Army National Guard, and having lunch. And he was talking about how difficult recruiting is. And I said, well, you know, if you'd look around you and look at the recruits or look at the potential recruits, maybe you wouldn't have such a hard time finding them. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, is there something wrong with me? And he looked at my husband who was with us, and he said, is she serious? And she's got a job with the governor. By this time, I was the deputy chief of staff. She's not serious. She wouldn't leave the governor's office to go to become... She wouldn't do that, would she? And John said, she is serious, and she would do that if she was eligible. So that was the question. Would she be eligible? It required an age waiver by that time, and I had to prove my physical fitness, and I did. It was a lot of fun. Some of the guys that found out that I had been recruited and was going to become public affairs thought, oh no, we've got a prima donna coming in from the governor's office. She's, you know, what is she going to know? And I could talk Navy, but I couldn't talk Army. That was a concern. And they said, you know, you'll go to a professional school. It's a gentleman's school. You'll have the weekends and evenings off. You'll wear civilian clothes. You know, it'll be great. So I did join. Did get the age waiver approved. Didn't think about a career, that I just wanted to help. So I was offered several opportunities, but what I wanted was to start where I left off. So I insisted that I be the same grade I was when I got out of the Navy. So I went in as an E5. That bothered some folks, but it didn't bother me because I wanted to roll my sleeves up. I wanted to do something. I wanted to be part of the team. I wanted to be part of the team. But that's going to get fixed, because what they didn't realize was the gentleman's school is not a gentleman's school at all. It was basic training. Because after you've been out of the military service, the Army requires you to go through basic training if you've been lapsed by a certain amount of time. So at 40-something years old, I'm going to put my body through the rigors of basic training all over again, minus an obstacle course and a gas chamber, which I had already done many years before in the Navy. We were all prior enlisted, all branches. I think the only thing we didn't have was Coast Guard. And I'm not going to hesitate to tell you that the biggest crybaby we had was a Marine. Was, I'm sure they didn't claim her anymore, but oh my goodness, but she could shoot. I don't know what the secret sauce is for Marines, but they can teach you to shoot. Just amazing talent. Yeah. But yes, it was basic training. It was sun up, sun down, you know, yelling. I remember the first time, you know, it's like they give you the task that they know you're going to fail at so they can, you know, get things started. So line up your suitcases in a straight line, which of course you fail at because they're not all alike. And then they yelled, get in the pit. And I just stood there for a second and watched people go running over to this sand pit. And I thought, a pit? I don't get into the pit. And then there was a voice in my head that said, run. And I took off for the pit.
I'm getting in the pit today.
I remember the first sergeant there the first time he laid eyes on me, we were running around a track, and they were kind of looking at all of us prior service people. And he saw me, and I overheard him tell the guy next to him, "Dang, she's old." And I thought, "Well, you ugly." I'm sorry, but, you know, I might be old, but you're ugly. That was just the way I had to get back at it. I had to develop something that I had not been challenged with yet, and that was my mind. That time in basic training taught me that the mind and the body will carry you further than anything you could ever imagine. I mean, it's just amazing when you get your mind wrapped around something and you're determined you're going to do it. I was determined I was going to do this. The first sergeant there was determined he was going to get me out. The guys were returning from the first phase of the operations over in the desert, and they thought it would be a good thing to put them in the training environment. So now you've got these prior service guys who are getting back in the game, and you got these guys coming back after they've been in the sandbox, as they were calling it, and they're not happy guys. They want to be home with their families, and they should have been. Now we've got them working, and it just wasn't a good environment for them. And things happen when things are not right. So one of the guys, while waiting for the next class to start, decided to have a relationship with one of the recruits there. It was a really bad thing. Unfortunately, as we get through the training period, she got pregnant as a result. He gave her some cash to go into town and take care of things. We get through the training period, and at one point, we're getting ready to hand out weapons, and she's just standing there in line, shaking, and I know for a fact she is not going to make it, and you just don't want her to have a weapon. I realized then that you have to be the adult. It doesn't really matter your rank anymore. So I stepped forward and asked for permission to speak and said she can't have a weapon. And our cadre said, "You and her go into the office." So we went in the office, and he came in, and he said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, this is what I understand happened before I got here. And this is who it happened with. And she's in no condition to have a weapon, especially a loaded weapon." So he called the chaplain, who came to get her, and she got the help she needed. She got support she needed. I understand that later she got to rejoin the class and move on, which was really great that they were able to take care of her the way they did. But in the meantime, the cadre put his head down in his hands, and he rubbed his hands on his head and his face and was looking down at the floor, and then finally looked up at me, and he goes, "You see, Lucas, this is why I don't want women in my army." And I thought, seriously? Are we still having this conversation? And I just kind of shook my head because, you know, the last time I checked, it takes two. So neither one was right. And it didn't have anything to do with women in his army. It had to do with his army taking care of his army. It had to do with battle buddies looking after each other. It had to do with where's your team and who separated you. Now I'm starting to speak some army talk at this point because I'm starting to see things that aren't quite right. They're better than they were, but they're still not right. There were a lot of things that happened during that period. At the end of it, unfortunately, the Army was not able to continue that training because it wasn't being done correctly. And the training shut down at Fort Knox and was moved to a different location as a result of some of the things that were going on there. That didn't leave a great taste in my mouth. You know, I wasn't really sure what I signed up for now.
Can you tell me, you know, what was your hardest day at basic? Did you have a day where you were like, "I made a big mistake"?
We were doing a trail run one day, and you had to run out and then you run back, and there were some obstacles along the trail that you had to overcome as well. We all went out. You had to do it in a certain amount of time. If you didn't, then you got a down time, and then you had to go back out and do it again. And it was a pass or fail situation. I went out and I did it the first time. And as I recall, I passed, but it was close. So several of us had to go back and do it again. It was fine. So I did. Second time, I did very well and was pleased with myself and thought, okay, cool, this is done. And that first sergeant came back to me and said, no, you need to go do it again. And I said, no, I passed. And he said, no, you didn't. You have to go do it again. And I really disliked him at this point. But I went out, and as I walked over to the start point, I remember feeling real anger for the first time. I mean, real nasty anger. And I called him some names in my head, and then I took off, and I used that anger. And that's what powered it through. And not only did I go the third time, but I did most excellent that third time around. And I realized that my feelings for that man were only going to make me better. I set out to prove him wrong. I remember the day we were, again, that dates me, but we had the bayonets on the end of our weapons, and we had the bayonet course. And so you stab the dummy, and they had some new ones, so they were nice and strong, all that. And I went up to that thing, and he said in the training, think of somebody or think of something. Well, you know who I thought of. And I took after that dummy like nobody's business. And it was that same first sergeant who called everybody around. I'm just stabbing this dummy, and he's standing there. I know he's standing there. And he starts calling people around to watch me do this. This is how this is done. This is the way you do this. And I'm thinking, it just made me even angrier that he was using me as an example. And it was, you know, it was my anger for him that was stabbing this dummy. But yeah, so if I could do anything coming out of the Army, I know I could stab a dummy.
So. Did people doubt you because of your age? Did it eventually become if Sergeant Lucas at 40 can do this, then I can do this?
I never felt the age, but every now and then you'd see someone who would look at me kind of like, oh, you know, it was that kind of surprise. But I used it as a motivator. So when we were out running as a unit, I loved running up behind people yelling, you know, 41 is behind you. If you don't, if I pass you, you're wrong. And then I would pass them. And yeah, it was a great motivator. And then we got the first deployment orders, and we were going to go. And I could not have been more excited. This was what it was all about. I was going to go do something. And then there's this thing called leadership. And some folks believe in leadership. They pursue it like a passion. They want to be the best leaders they can. They want to understand the science behind leadership. They want to understand the empathy behind leadership. They want to be good leaders. And then you have some who don't know a good grade of apple butter. I guess that's the nicest way I can say that. And we unfortunately had our top dog in that deployment. It was very unfortunate, the difficulties. When your top leader is not worthy of that job, everyone has to shift, and you have to make a choice. You don't think about it at the time, but you're going to make a choice. You're either going to hate that person and make life miserable, or you're going to realize the shortcoming of that individual and find a way to build a team to make it right. Not to make that person right, not to make that good, but to make your life good, to make your battle buddy's life good. And that's what happened. The the team pulled together and we made that work. We made that deployment happen so that we do have some good memories of it. It took us a while to get over the bad leadership. Bad leadership, we talk about PTSD and stuff like that. It can cause some serious issues. And it did for some. It was unfortunate the way it happened, but it did. But we got through it. And we come back and realize that there's a new building and they forgot to put us in it. So we have to carve a way into an office space. When you're gone, you know, holes get filled. And so anyway, we found a way to make ourselves known again and work our way in, do all the things you do. And then we get second. Well, there's another deployment, and this one's going to Afghanistan. It's the 226 out of Mobile. And I'm thinking, yeah, that'd be a nice deployment. So I do my best to get on there and finally got on at the last minute and did my tour in Afghanistan. Wow, what an amazing thing. Meeting the peoples, the locals, working with some of the kids. It was one little girl that grabbed hold of me and just didn't want to let go. I taught her how to do some Girl Scout stuff that I'd learned and thought I'd forgotten, and she took a liking to me. And it just tears your heart out when you have to let go. Behind the camera, it's pretty easy because you just look at things and take pictures, and you don't really get that involved. When I got home and I looked at pictures of one in particular, was a big trash heap, and there was a what looked like maybe a brother, sister, young kids, maybe, I don't know, 8, 9 at the most, and a donkey. And the donkey was going through the trash looking for food, and so were the two kids. And it was just a shot that I took on the side of the road, traveling at whatever speed. And when I realized what I'd gotten, it breaks your heart. Afghanistan was a good tour. It was a tough tour. But it was even harder to watch what happened when we finally walked out of there. That was tough. That was really tough. Back again after the Afghanistan tour, and we go into, our usual thing, just the guard and what we do. And then I got what would become my last tour, which was Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I got to go with a really great team. We were small. We were mighty. We didn't have enough to do. So we occasionally found things to get into. But that was a really good tour. You get to a point where, like I said earlier, you want people to be educated, to have information, to make decisions, to think about what they're doing. And by this time, I'm there. I'm thinking. I'm very aware of what's going on. And you realize that the military is not just a place that you sign up and go to because you love your country or you want somebody to pay for your debt or your college degree. It becomes so much more than that, because it's even beyond the way of life. It's a whole political system. It's how the political system plays on the military, how they portray the military. You know, they love us. They want to stand beside us and take their picture while we're in uniform. And then, well, how much does it cost when you want something or you need something? You know, we know all the stories. We know at the beginning of the conflicts that we didn't have armored up vehicles, you know, and then there was a question of cost. Well, some soldiers, you know, with some ingenuity said, no, we just weld this on here and that'll, you know, oh, okay. There's a lot there that doesn't get tapped into because we have to do all the political correct things. is there a base that doesn't have a contractor doing grass work and all that other stuff? Yeah, nobody likes to do it, but it builds a character when you have to do that stuff. I still think we should do that stuff. I know, I'm old school. But I also think that the military needs to capitalize on their best asset, which is their sailors, soldiers, airmen. Get them the technology that they need. Listen to their ideas. There's so much talent there that doesn't get used the way it should. The great thing is that when these guys get out, you know, they get to go into the private sector and use that talent. If they're not so jaded, and that's where I'm at now. And I'm working in the State Veterans Affairs Office. And one of the things that I really am struggling with is when you get out, what is your next step? It's a sad day when the only thing you want to do is get your 100% disability. Because you got so much more going for you. You've got all these opportunities. And as I start, I've only been in a job about a year and a half. And I'm thinking, God, look at this job. If I were an engineer, I'd jump at this job. And we can't fill it. Well, why can't we fill this job? It pays super well. It's got just enough travel in it. It's got great benefits. What's the deal? Well, the deal is the guy who would be great at that job has been convinced that he should be working toward 100% disability instead of what the next thing is. And we've got to change that mindset. We've got to encourage our veterans to not, don't get me wrong, there is health care, there are benefits, they've earned them, they have a right to them, and they should have them. But the great thing about being in the military and the camaraderie is that we're all working to be the best we can be. Nobody worked to be broken. We all worked to be good. We chased each other. We ran, you know, hey, I don't think there were very many guys in the Army who said, I love running. There are a handful, but not a lot. But you made it a thing. Everybody got out there, you know, and you know, you just died on the vine when the smoker waxed all of you, you know, and you wondered how that guy could smoke the way he does and yet outrun everybody. So you tried a little harder next time to be the one who came in. I was always striving for 300. I hit it once, and I stayed above 250 most of the time. As later in my career, I never went below 200. But it's after I got fit. Before, it was kind of getting there was an act. But my point is, when we're working together to be the best we can be, we do a lot of different things. We do things differently. We think differently. We're healthier. We're better. So, you know, as you go through the military career, the one thing I guess I'd really love to see is not how do I get my 100% disability, but let me fill this paperwork out so I know that I can take care of my family in the future. I know my death isn't going to be a burden to anybody because I know where I can be buried because I pre-signed up for it. I know my child has school money because I, you know, am eligible for this scholarship and they're going to go to school. And now I'm going to use their program to get a really great job and do even more. Veterans don't die. We're not broken. We're not stupid. We're given information that isn't really presented the way it needs to be done, I think. And so if I had a message, it would be keep on. We don't stop just because we take the uniform off. In fact, my colleague sitting here next to me is one who came up with a t-shirt logo for us that our service never stops. And that doesn't mean you have to be working all the time. But it does mean that you got a lot more to give. And we need that. We, as a country, as a whole, need you more now than ever. in all the values and all the talents that you bring.
Thank you so much, First Sergeant Lucas. She was my first sergeant.
Was she really?
Yeah, when she was in. So that was a lot of fun to sit down and talk with her. A little blast of the past for me. After that, we decided to go talk to some real-life recruiters to get their take on some of the stuff happening in the Guard and the recruiting world.
I'm actually really excited to go to this recruiting station and talk to them because as, like, you know, an ex-recruiter, I'm nervous. I hope they don't ask us for leads when we go, but I guess we'll see.
All right, yeah. So for this one, we're taking it outside of the studio, and we're going to sit down and talk with Staff Sergeant Reese Corbett, Sergeant First Class David Dennis, and Staff Sergeant Jennifer Jallo.
In recruiting school, they teach us, you know, there's only like 5 reasons that somebody joins, but really there's a million reasons that people join. You know, health insurance is a big reason when you deal with older people. You get kids that are out of high school or out of college that are looking for something to do. You know, maybe they just got married. Maybe they found out they're about to have their first baby or whatever. Health insurance all of a sudden becomes important. They didn't care anything about that 6 years ago. Student loan repayment's a huge one right after college because coming out of high school, you got this goal that you're going to go to UA and party it up and you're going to be in this frat and it's going to be the greatest time of your life and roll out of college. You get a first job that you thought you were going to make $200,000 a year at, and you make $60,000, but you got $110,000 of student loan debt. We get a lot of people that jump back over for that, but call them unicorns because they don't exist. You might get one a year that is like, wants to join because he wants to be in the military. No medical issues, no legal issues, no education issues. Like, you meet the dude on Monday, Friday, he's signing a contract. But they really don't exist. And the only thing that makes recruiters good recruiters is being able to find out why you want to join. Like, you can't stick to those 5 things. It's find a reason that they need the Guard and then help them realize that they do need the Guard to be successful in that form, or even if it's short term, right? Help us help you get back on your feet, and then you can go do whatever you want. You can live the life you wanted to live. This could be a stepping stone for you. It doesn't have to be a career.
From my population, I have high schoolers and immigrants. And I had one applicant who's now a soldier. He had just came from Africa, came with, you know, green card and everything. And back home in Africa, he has a master's. He works at the pharmacy. Like, he has a good on there. So I'm like, why did you come here, you know? But when he came here, he said, well, he wanted like a better opportunity for his family to support his family. I'm like, okay, well, let's see what we could do for you. And one of the hiccups that he had to encounter was the education. So having a master's there and compared to here, like getting that transferred, it was almost nothing, like almost a bachelor's. Compared to over there was master's and vice versa over here, having a master's here, that's everything back home in Africa. So just like kind of like instead of him coming as a specialist, came in as an E3. I'm like, well, hey, if you know anyone that wants to join, I could help you get promoted. Just, you know, so that was just that little hiccup. But for him to join and to be able to support his family financially with health insurance because he has wife and kids. And he's also pretty older. But the positive change that happened to him, he's very grateful. And for me, that was just like shock to me because I'm like, you have it good in Africa where it's like cheaper, cost of living is cheaper. You're pretty much head of your job. But here, he wanted something different and to explore that training, that support. And also like to give back to his country and also thank this country in positive ways.
So I've got a soldier. It's actually my first ever enlisted soldier when I got this job. She also came from Africa, mother of 2. Her husband at the time lived in Boston, and she was down here finishing her degree. We waited until she got her degree, but I asked her, I was like, you're about to get a degree. You know, you're about to go into, you know, flight school. You don't need this. Like, why are you doing this? And she's like, I feel like I owe it. That was my first ever soldier. So then I was kind of, that was like my, eyes opening moment, like, whoa, you know, what we do really matters. Like, these people actually do want to to join for more than just, oh, well, I want the money for school, or I want the money for, you know, I want the extra income each month. No, there is some people out there who really do have a calling. Now, in my high schools, you see, I guess, a lot of, I need it to pay for college. You know, I don't want to go into debt. I saw my parents have this debt. They talked to me about it. Or it's the, hey, I want to do something cool. You know, I don't want to just go in and be, you know, in a trade school. I want to, you know, work on helicopters. I want to work on tanks. I want to be able to go and, like, do something that you don't get to do in the civilian world. But the patriotism, you don't really see it maybe much as more, you know, because if you looked at this, like, from a high schooler's point of view, it's kind of like a company, you know, the money, the benefits, you know, you show up to work, then you go back home. That's kind of how we view it. And so I, you know, patriotism doesn't really fall into that. There hasn't been a reason to, maybe for a long time, and that's kind of faded. I think we can all kind of see that that's faded out of society a little bit. But I've been incredibly humbled by some of the immigrants that I've had the opportunity to work with, almost like they feel a debt to America, and this is their way to pay it back. It's rare that we find somebody who's like, look, my father joined, my grandfather, my mom, my grandma, they all join, I'm joining, this is what I want to do. That's really, really, really rare. A lot of the times, they're just afraid to make a commitment. I mean, they hear 6 years, and they're like, I could be out of college by that point. Like, that's really scary. I mean, I know it was for me, too. I have a brother and a sister, the Woodley twins. They're the same age, out of my largest school, Gardendale High School. They did not even talk with me when I came to the school the first time. I was supposed to pull them out of class, and they told their teacher they weren't going to go. So immediately I left. Saw them at a lunchroom display later on in the school year, and was like, you know, hey, you two, like, come and talk to me. Come get a shirt. Because they were the only two that had been asking questions in a classroom presentation that I had put on at the school. As of right now, they're both at training in MP up at Fort Leonard Wood. So they're both going to be MPs. But the moment I got them to actually sit down and talk with me, they were like, you know, we just don't know if we want to do this. Like, we both know we're going to get some scholarship money. And I was like, well, are you going to be able to pay for everything? No. Well, okay. Well, look, I have a solution for that. It was probably 7 months. I mean, you saw them here. They're great kids, both really physically fit. They were just afraid of the commitment. Now, the fact that we had two open slots in the same unit for the same job, in which they were both interested in because their father is a police officer for Birmingham, that made their decision, I think, a lot easier because we don't have the buddy system anymore. But if you can find the same slot in a unit and there's multiple of them and two people know each other, you can put them in that slot. So the fact that they were able to kind of go with each other, I think, helped. But I mean, it was an 8-month process at least, you know, keeping them on my funnel and constantly having to explain, they're just not ready yet. You know, they're not ready to sign. You see that a lot, I think. Yeah. Especially with high schoolers.
Good rule of thumb. If a kid calls you and wants to join, you probably can't. So that's the normal circumstance that you see. Usually they've already talked to another recruiter.
Yep.
They've already talked to another branch. They already know they can't enlist, and they're trying to bounce between the system to see if there's a way they can get in. Those are the unicorns we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. You will get a unicorn every once in a while that wants to enlist, that's 100% ready to go, but usually they have a permanent disqualification and cannot get in the guard. Whether it's testing, you know, maybe they've already taken the test 3 times in the last 90 days and didn't pass the ASVAB. At a certain level, well, now they have a 6-month wait, but they don't think that we can see it because the Navy tested them, but we can see all of it. Or they have a medical condition that limits them completely. You know, they're on medication that they can't come off of, but the military won't allow you to join on that medication, and they hold it. They're really the most dangerous applicants as, like, to a recruiter, because as they bounce between recruiters, they learn what they can't say. You know, they learned that, like, oh, this guy was calling me every day and we were going the right path until I told him about this, so I won't tell this guy about it. And then you get to MEPS and you find out, like, oh, the reason that, you know, you worked with the Air Force for 6 months and the Navy for 3 months and never joined was because when you got to this point, they already knew. Very rarely do you see somebody that's like, I really want to join. I got what it takes. You know, I'm here. We can go Friday. And it's like, cool, this guy's going. Usually, even your boss, you know, our Yates that are on our team immediately are going to go, what's wrong with him? What's going on? Because something's going on and he's not telling us. And they're 99.9% of the time, they're right. We're going to find something that is a complete disqualifier, and these kids are just bouncing around from recruiter to recruiter seeing if they can skim by.
Do you guys find, like, pride in watching the people that you put in when they graduate PCT, AIT, or if they decide that they want to go do, like, a special school or something? Like, if you have a kid that goes and they're like, I want to be an engineer, but then they, you know, go to Sabre school or something, like, do you hold that with you, or is it something where you're just kind of cheering them on from afar? Like, what is
Well, you get an opportunity to kind of follow, you know, your soldiers' careers, you know, and I know, you know, we haven't been in it maybe quite long enough to see, like, real trajectories for some of these soldiers, but, you know, like, you put somebody in into an airborne unit, and then they graduate airborne school, and they come back, and they have that airborne patch on. You know, there's a lot of pride with that. But that's the most important part of this job, is the fact that what we do matters, and it will matter for a long time. Like, we all remember the day that we enlisted, you know, and had that, you know, the swearing ceremony and that red velvet room and all that. It was really cool. So to be able to see that and see other kids do it and then see the reactions from their families, then you go to awards day and you get to call them up on stage and you get to hand them a certificate, and the ovation that they get, you know, from, you know, all the parents, you know, it's just recognizing, you know, the decision that they made. And then seeing, you know, the text messages after and saying, hey, you know, I really appreciate you helping me. You know, I didn't think that this was something I wanted to do. I didn't think that this was something that I could do. Because again, we face a lot of challenges putting some of these kids in. You know, I've got a girl right now at the University of Alabama. She's going to go be a lawyer. The only way she could have paid for that was through the Guard. That was it. She had no way. She made good grades, but just not enough to get a full ride there. So the fact that she did this now, and it's giving her the opportunity to go to school and most likely end up being the first person in her family with a degree, yeah, there's a ton of pride with that. I mean, that's the motivation I think a lot of us have to get up and put the uniform on and go and sit down with all these kids. Because it can be, you know, stressful at times, difficult at times, but ultimately, like, you're not doing it for you. You're doing it for them.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AGR Alabama Guard Radio, and feel free to follow us on social media and let us know what you think about the episode. You can find us at Alabama Guard on Instagram and Alabama National Guard on Facebook.
This was a fun episode to record. We really appreciate everyone who's been sticking with us. And as always, we want to thank everyone who sat down and talked with us, and thank Staff Sergeant Thomas Furlow for composing all the music for this episode.
And if you've heard some of the stories shared and you have a story that you'd like to share, slide into our DMs on Instagram.
Until next time, this has been AGR.